5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on.
The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, 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 good evening. Here we are again, and it's the new Panic Room, so I'm guessing it's Thursday yet again. They keep coming on round. It seems like only yesterday we did all this nonsense before, but here we are again. Episode 176, and it is the 13th of February, and it's Valentine's Day Eve, and I'm all single and alone, so I really don't give a fuck, to be honest with you. So, saving a fortune, not having to buy stuff, but which is great. I mean, you know, I look at it as a sort of a money saving scheme, but you know, I'm just getting old and miserable. I think that's my problem. Anyway, speaking of things old and miserable, perfect segue. I think it's time to bring her on. That was, wasn't it? It was great. I'm just miserable. I'm just turned into a miserable old fart. I have to admit, you know. But I hope you and your loved one have a nice Valentine, blah 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 blah, and all that, you know, bullshit. But I hope you have a nice time. You know, it's I'm jaded. I think jaded.
I'm sitting here with my stuffed pink hippo that I got for, pre-Valentine's, a little stuffed animal here. And so he's keeping me company in the office while I do the show. And there's that. He's really cute. I should send a picture. I should post a picture of him because he's adorable.
You should
adorable.
Do that. That would be great. Yeah, in fact, my daughter got me some chocolates and stuff, which was really sweet, bless her. And she was that excited. She gave them to me this evening, so it was wonderful. And that's great. That it's just worth it for me. That's great. But I would be. I don't know. It's a strange one. You know, I've been sort of, single for a while now. And, I think the horrible thing is I'm probably getting used to it. I just like being able to sit up in bed and watch TV and watch what I want and, you know, sleep when I want. Just, I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting too used to it. I think that's the problem.
Yeah. There is something to be said for, doing whatever that, but you know what, you have kids, so it's not the same because, you said speaking of old
yeah,
and miserable.
But I think, I have time with the kids naturally, but I mean, certainly as they're getting older, that they're doing more and more doing their own thing, but, when the kids are doing their own thing or they've gone to bed or whatever, at least that is my time. You know, and I'm not stuck watching TV shows I don't want to watch. I watch exactly what I want to watch. I'm binge watching King of the Hill at the moment. It's been a long time since I watched. What a great show! Having recently, I've binge watched Family Guy, American Dad, because they're all on Hulu. So I just plow through them. Well, it's one of those things. You say that I have a lunch break. I just flick the TV on, or in the morning. When India's getting ready for school and we're having breakfast, we tend to watch Bob's Burgers or Futurama's Another Face. So it's just like those little 20-minute, half-hour shows that just kill that bit of time. I've just started watching, it's a UK show, Netflix show, called Sex Education, and it is
heard of that.
Brilliant. Seriously, it's like dark British humor. It's about sort of high school kids. It's got Gillian Anderson in it. I've always had a major crush on her, and she's still gorgeous, and B, she's fantastic in it.
Wow.
And it's about a kid whose mum is a sex therapist. And he sort of falls into being a relationship and sex counselor for money at his school, and there's all the thing going on without him. And I recommend it. You know, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a little bit naughty,
yeah.
But it's and if anybody who's ever been a teenager can relate. Just like trials and tribulations of school. You know, it's all there.
Speaking of teenagers, guess who has a double date tomorrow? My son.
He's going out with two girls or what? How does that work then?
He says they're just friends. Him and his this girl. I don't remember her name. But anyway, she calls him like all the time, and you know she'll call him crying, and he'll come to her rescue, and they'll talk for hours. But he says they're just friends, but they're going with her friend and a guy. So it's two girls and two guys. Valentine's Day, and they're going to see a chick flick. But he says it's, you know, they're just friends. It's not a date. And I'm like, oh, sure. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But...
mm-hmm.
But it's cute. Yes.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, good luck to him. I hope you... Make sure you have the talk.
Talk.
And you know, he said... Sure, you said, just remember, tits first.
Is that that's the talk? You know, I don't know if his mom should
have
that talk.
He needs to know nothing more. With that under his belt, he will be a conqueror of women. Trust me.
Tits first. Okay,
tits
all right,
first.
I got it.
Yeah. Yeah, don't go straight for minge. You'll get your face slapped. Tits first. Do it properly. There is a protocol. Okay.
There is.
There you go.
I should be excited to be held her hand. So I'm going for a hold her hand. You know, that's where my mind is. But he's 16,
it's a start, isn't it? It's somewhere to start.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I might be more excited than he is. hopefully I have something good to report next week. You know that it went well.
He'll be playing it cool. He'll be all giddy and excited. And, yeah. No. Well. Good. Best of luck to the lad. I hope it goes well. You must give us all the deets next week.
Definitely.
All the deets. But anywho. And I ask this every week. In fact. I'm gonna play the jingle.
Into a week in the morning, and I step outside, and I take a deep breath, and I get real high, and I scream from the top of my lungs, what's going on? And I say, hey, yeah. I said, hey, what's going on? And I
So, hey, Xtina, what is going on?
You know, some weeks I try to pretend like I might know a little bit or have an idea, but you know what? I don't have a clue what's going on this week. This week has been a blur. Like, it's just,
I know the feeling. Suddenly it's Thursday, and you know, hang on, it was a Monday, like, 2 seconds ago. What's gone on?
Yes.
But, yeah, to be fair, Hellbound Books wise, obviously we launched our Bizarro anthology a couple of weeks ago, and so a lot going on behind the scenes, I have to say, and there'll be a big burst of activity next month, so you just have to watch this space, or watch the website, because it's all, and it's something Xena doesn't bother to do, you know, even though we spent a vast amount of money to make it look sexy, can't even be bothered.
I do.
be honest. Can't be bothered.
I look sometimes and I go, wow, that's really good. Yeah. I notice it around the holidays when you dress him up for like Christmas. You know, is he dressed up for Valentine's? I doubt he is. He should have like
a little Cupid arrow on him or something. But I do worry that, you know, the little Christmas hat on our demon guy could be over the top, you know, at Christmas. I don't want to overdo
that.
It.
That's so cute.
He just looks so sweet. But we need to name him, you know. We should do that. We should have a competition to name the Hellbound Books demon.
He's
our little guy, you know, and he's ours and we love him, and yeah, we don't have a name for him, so
I like that.
It was something like Keith or something, but show wise I mean, I'm assuming we have something going on. Do tell.
We do. I'm excited. We have two great guests tonight. Our first guest is going to be, let me read the thing here. Oh, yeah, there it goes. Historical fantasy writer James Palmer. So historical fantasy.
Ooh,
you know,
historical fantasy.
I'm going to try not to ask him what time period this falls into, you know, historical. So.
No, history.
It's just contemporary.
It's history. Yeah. That just covers everything. If it's not contemporary history, and that's it, you know. So, you know, be happy with that. Be happy
and
with that. I need to. It'd be great to have a chat. I've literally just typed the end on a young adult historical fiction novel. Funnily enough, set in Regency period England. So So there we go. You know, something in common.
Yeah. Awesome. And
you don't know what to say to that. You said, Jimbo, that sounds dumb. That sounds very, but it's not. It's good. It's got action. It's got intrigue. It's got murder. It's got mystery. It's got shirtless farmhands. It's got everything. It's great. Yeah. Plus a bit of history. There's a fair bit of history on the top of my head because we actually studied that era back when we did social and economic history from the agricultural revolution. So it covers most of that period. So I was delighted.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
There you go.
And for our second segment, we have science fiction fantasy author and poet. I'm excited.
Poetry.
Yeah,
like a bit
right?
Of you know I love my poetry, Xtina. you know I love it. Only if it rhymes. If it doesn't rhyme, it's just words. It's just words and it's lazy. So, you know, that's my take on it. Free form.
I hope.
What it is, lazy, idle. You know?
Yeah, I used to agree with you. I did. I swear I did. I used to be like, I just don't get it if it doesn't rhyme. And, you know, now I'm all about the free verse. So, you know, each their own, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I'm going to introduce our first guest. Do you have the button ready? You're going to
I am poised.
Okay, our first guest is historical fantasy writer James Palmer. Woo!
Good evening, sir.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. How are you, sir?
Can you hear me?
We can. Can you hear us? We are tremendous.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. So, historical fantasy. Do tell. Can you define that?
Well, that's just for lack of a better term to call it. It's kind of a it's a twisty, turny, time travel-y thing with Lovecraftian elements. It has real historical characters matching wits with literary characters, and it's just a lot of just craziness.
Oh wow, that sounds fun! So you take real life characters from history and fuck with them, basically.
Basically, I dig them up and put them through their paces again.
Mixed in
a lot of public domain literary characters as well.
Uh-huh. I love that. I've never heard of that. As I say, you probably heard, I've literally just finished ghostwriting a historical fiction book myself, a young adult historical fiction set in Regency period England. So for anybody who's seen Blackadder, they know exactly what I'm talking about. The third series of Blackadder. And it was so much fun. I have to say, one of the things I like about writing historical stuff is, you know, the lack of technology. Because, you know, when you're writing in contemporary, which for Xtina's benefit is modern day, you've got, you know, there's so many things. I mean, it's like this one I've been writing. I thought if she'd had a cell phone, you know, or a car, she'd have got out of it like that. You know, half of this plot wouldn't have worked. But because there's no cell phone, you know, all of that, it was great, you know, and, you know, for the police to be summoned, somebody actually had to get on horseback, ride for an hour to go get the police, you know, that sort of thing's great because it just adds a whole new dimension. But, you know, writing, because again, any writer will tell you, one of the first things you have to consider now when you're writing is how to eliminate the cell phone. You know, you see it in a lot of horror movies. You know, they get broken, the signal gets shot, whatever. You know, it's always, they have to get around it because it's just so easy. Just pick up the cell phone and away you go. And either whether, you know, they're researching something or, again, in the old days, they used to all go down the library and used to go through the Dewey Decimal System and pick out the books and do all of that. And I think it was better days back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Simpler, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, I'm Gen X. So I grew up, you know, before I didn't have a cell phone until I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have internet until I started college, and I started out writing a lot of what we call new pulp or pulp stuff, writing old characters in the 30s and 40s, and they're using payphones and rotary phones, and they have to go to the library and look stuff up. They're out somewhere and they can't just call somebody. They got to stop by a payphone and.
Yeah.
Or, you know, borrow a telephone or something. So I'm kind of used to that. It's not a weird transition. Mm-hmm. I write either that or near future stuff. I don't think I've written a story yet where somebody had a cell phone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oddly enough.
Well, they are a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, you know, you can't ignore it, but they are a problem because it's just so easy. I mean, it's like. I know we've had this conversation on the show before, you know, and it's frightening. You can do anything on your phone. I do my banking while I'm on the toilet. Seriously, you know, I can do my banking. I can pay my bills. I can surf the web. There's not much you can't. I can take pictures of my poo when I've finished and post it. You know, it's everything, and it's scary. And of course, the frightening thing is that. Nothing compares to that spine-chilling, soul-crunching horror when you can't remember where you put your phone down.
Right.
It is just like, oh, geez, you know, and because I've got like two or three places around the house where I will put my phone down, and if I just by chance rest it somewhere, you know, without thinking. And I have to get the kids to phone me. I have to get them to phone me to find my damn phone. And I'm separated from my phone. My life is on that phone. It's just like everything to me. Everything is there. I could quite happily conduct my entire life from it. Yeah.
Pretty much. We were actually here. We were laying in bed because, you know, I don't get up until noon. And to hear a noise outside, you know, at the front door. And the boyfriend just pulls up the app for the I guess the doorbell cam to see what's going on out there. Like, seriously?
Yeah.
Don't I gotta
instead
get
of
get,
getting out of bed, just, you know, peeping through the curtain like proper people.
Yes. It's great.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. My old next door neighbor, where I used to live, was a Vietnamese guy, great guy, but very, very into technology. And I remember he was still at the bus stop, you know, waiting for the kids' bus to come. And he said, literally from his phone, not only could he do all that, he could control his air conditioning, his heating, he could turn his lights on, he could turn his cooker on if he wanted. And it was funny, he was showing I could do that, and his app crashed. And the look of sheer panic on that man's face, like, and I like he could no longer control the temperature in his house was just magical. It really was.
I was I was cleaning a couple of weeks ago, and the Wi-Fi was out, and you know, I'm like, okay, Google, it's gonna make noisy. Yeah, and it said, sorry, you know, check your internet connection or whatever. So I did this like 3 times, and it kept telling me to check my internet connection. And finally, I was like, Google, why? You know, why be forgetting me, you know? So we're way too reliant, I think, on these.
Yes, that is the worry. Yeah, everything's great until your Wi-Fi connection drops, and then it's like,
yes.
It's like somebody's just ripped your heart out. What do I do now? Well, how do I survive now? You know,
yeah,
exactly. Just kill myself. So, James, one James, another, here to talk to us about your book, The Map of Time. Great tagline. Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton has come unstuck in time. So I'm just intrigued by the tagline. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, now this is actually the fourth in a series. It's called the Shadow. It's in the Shadow Council Archives kind of universe that John Harkness at Falstaff Books came up with. It fits in more or less with his. He has a series called Quincy Harker Demon Hunter. So it's just. The basic premise of it is Richard Francis Burton encounters weird things, mostly Lovecraftian kind of threats. In this book, he's tangling with Morlocks. Somebody has brought Morlocks back in time to his London and has put them under the streets of London, and he's trying to figure out who did that and why. And Mycroft Holmes, who is Sherlock Holmes' smarter older brother, has been given a timeline of every future event between now and the end of the 20th century or thereabouts. And he's going to use that to kind of seek and hold power, and it'll unravel history. So Burton has to... figure out who gave him the map of time, get it back. So like I said, there's lots of Morlocks. The time traveler from H.G. Wells is in here.
Oh, wow.
He goes to an alternate World War II and meets Aleister Crowley and Ian Fleming.
Oh.
Excellent. I love it. The Time Machine is one of my favorite novels of all time. One of my favorite films, actually, the original one, not the remake they made with Guy Pearce, the original one.
I love the George Powell, Time Machine. That movie's great. So yeah, this you know, I used a lot of that to kind of that sort of imagery, the way he travels through time and stuff, and the look of the Morlocks. But I've had fun with this series. It started out, I wanted to do the first book, The Depths of Time, came about because I had the idea of Richard Francis Burton traveling back in time with Captain Nemo aboard the Nautilus, and they fight Cthulhu.
Oh, wow.
But John Harkness wanted 4 books, so after I wrote that one, I had to come up with 3 more. So I had to figure out some more stuff for Burton to do. And I thought it would be cool, you know, what if he meets, you know, public domain Victorian literary characters? So he meets Professor Challenger. He meets the Time Traveler. He meets Mycroft Holmes. and then historical characters. He meets and assisting him in all this is a policeman named Inspector Frederick Aberline, who was the policeman in charge of the Jack the Ripper investigation.
Oh, wow, fantastic.
I like how
you're sort of mixing them all together. I love that. Is this something that has been done before, or is this all new to me?
I haven't seen it done. It sounded interesting, and I thought of a way I could make it work. I like taking, you know, and I use Lovecraft stuff too. So I liked blending those. You know, he tangles with Shoggoths and you know, Yog-Sothoth, and he meets a character I made up based on the Shadow over Innsmouth. Just all kinds of I had great fun with it. I love that Victorian time period anyway. I love steampunk. And just the character of Richard Burton himself. I mean, he was an amazing real life, you know, pulp hero. He was a spy, a writer, a swordsman, an explorer. He's one of the first white men to go to Mecca. He went in disguise. Nobody knew he was a white man or they would have killed him.
Oh, wow.
You know, he just did all these incredible things. So I have him, and then I have his friends in the – he was in a group called the Cannibal Club. So a lot of those guys show up in that too. And one of his friends was the poet Algernon Charles Swinburne. And I had a lot of fun, you know, having them kind of interact and – kind of see what Burton was doing, you know, running around doing weird stuff for Mycroft Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Moriarty makes an appearance in this series. I mean, it's just craziness, like I said before. And the second book actually made it onto the SFWA or SIFWA's Nebula Award recommended reading list last year.
Oh, fantastic. Impressive.
That was kind of cool. I mean, that's as far as it went, but I still count that as a win. That was very special.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear more of The Map of Time. Do you have an excerpt to read for us?
I do. Let me pull that up here. I was trying to decide what to read. I didn't want to give away anything. Or anything like that, but let me, this is actually from chapter 3, this deals with some stuff that happened in the previous book called The Dream Key. But let me start here. The hansom carried Burton and Aberline through the gates of Bedlam and up to the high stone steps. "Are you sure you want to do this?" asked Aberline. "We had a long night." The explorer looked at the policeman, a grim expression souring his already hard countenance. "I must, Frederick." He had returned home with the dawn to a letter brought earlier the previous evening by a messenger from a Dr. Seward at Brightmoor Asylum. It said that Algy wanted to see him at once. Let's see. Okay, Aberline nodded, and the two got out. Burton paid the fare, and the two men started up the steps to the tall oaken doors. Aberline stared up at the imposing edifice and shivered. "I've never liked this place," he muttered, as if he feared the building would hear him and take offense. Burton simply nodded and hauled open one of the oaken double doors. As they did so, they heard a muffled wailing coming from somewhere inside, the cry of some tortured soul. Burton wrinkled his nose as they entered. The smell of antiseptic masking vomit and urine assaulted his nostrils. They moved to the front desk and rang the bell. The biggest woman Burton had ever seen looked up at him impatiently. "Yes?" "I'm here to see a patient of yours," said Burton. "Algernon Charles Swinburne." "Sign your name here," she said, pointing to a ledger. Burton dipped the nib pen in ink and scrawled his name. The woman spun the ledger around and read it. Oh, Captain Burton, Dr. Seward has been expecting you. Will you take me to him, please? Follow me. The woman stepped through an adjoining door into the hallway, and Burton and Aberline followed. They came to a row of doors, and the woman knocked on one of them. They heard a muffled come in, and she opened the door. Dr. Seward, she said, Captain Burton is here to see Mr. Swinburne. Burton heard the creak of a wooden chair, and a man popped his head out the door, smiling at Burton. Hello, he said, stepping into the corridor. I'm Dr. John Seward. He extended his hand, and Burton took it, giving the man a brisk shake. Who is your associate? Detective Inspector Frederick Aberline, said the policeman, shaking hands with Seward as well. Splendid. Well, I know you want to see about your friend right away. He has been a most interesting case. When he began asking for you, I knew I must get word to you immediately. I'm glad you did, said Burton. Are you sure my presence won't hinder his healing? On the contrary, said Seward. I believe seeing you may bring him back to himself, if you will follow me. Taking a ring of ponderous keys from the nurse, Seward led Burton and Aberline through a veritable maze. The urine and vomit smell was stronger, and behind heavy doors they heard more sounds of human torment. Stopping in front of one of the doors, Seward inserted one of the heavy keys and unlocked it. His is a most unusual case. Mr. Swinburne is quite a brilliant poet. I've been familiarizing myself with his work. Burton and Aberline followed Seward into a padded cell. Swinburne huddled in the far corner of that room, tied in a straitjacket, drooling. Is this how you treat all of your patients? Said Burton, scowling. My apologies, Captain Burton. Mr. Swinburne tends to get overwrought at times. He's been, finding ways to hurt himself. For instance, goading the orderlies into thrashing him. He seems to, enjoy it. Burton nodded. Yes, Algy's body interprets pain as pleasure. Ah, said Seward. So he was like this, before? Well, it's very interesting. But what I'm most interested in is his state of mind. He has shared with me some most outrageous things, things I've never heard before from any of my other patients. His psychosis is very peculiar. Swinburne is a peculiar fellow, Aberline offered. Burton silenced him with a stare. You'd be in a similar state if your mind had been imprisoned for weeks inside an alien body in the remote past, Burton wanted to say to the policeman. He had been forbidden by Mycroft Holmes from discussing the exact particulars of what happened to the poet, and at any rate, had he told anyone the truth, he'd likely be tied in a straitjacket right next to Swinburne. I assume that is what you wanted to see me about? Yes, said Seward, addressing Swinburne. He said, Algy, you have visitors, Captain Burton and Inspector Aberline. Swinburne stared straight ahead, not looking at either of them, a glazed look in his eyes. His fiery red hair was flayed all about his head. Talk to him, Seward urged. It may do some good for you both. He stepped out of the way as Burton leaned toward his friend. Algy? Richard? My hat! I need a drink. I know, old friend. I'm sorry. At first, Burton had thought his friend had suffered no ill effects from having his mind replaced by a member of the time-traveling great race of Yith. But then, weeks later, he started to be tormented by strange dreams of his captivity in the deep past. Then other things began to assail him. Hallucinations, foul moods. It got so bad his parents had him committed. Bloody hell, Richard, the Shoggoths. The Shoggoths are all gone, Algy. No, just sleeping, said the poet. That which is dead can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. What, said Burton. He had heard that sinister phrase before, uttered by the deceased John Henning speak in his own dreams. It sounded even worse coming from Swinburne's lips, more real and therefore more dangerous. Time out of joint, said Swinburne. Captain Richard Francis Burton has come unstuck in time. My Aunt Petunia's pretty lace bonnet, unstuck. Captain Bloody Richard Gloucester Place Burton. He's out of his tree, Aberline mused. Burton ignored him. Algernon, what do you mean time is out of joint? What do you mean I've come unstuck? Time, Richard, it's off kilter. Mycroft knows. Mycroft Bloody Holmes well knows. Look at the Sphinx. The Sphinx, Algy, in Egypt? The White Sphinx, the poet corrected, shaking his head. On the hill, the damned Morlocks, in the tunnels, Richard. Don't go in the tunnels. How's that?
Wow. That was, you know, just perfect.
It was lovely to hear Bloody Hell, actually. I love that. You don't You certainly do not hear that from in Texas unless it's from me. So, loving it. Loving it. No, it's great. Beautifully read.
Thank you. I love British swearing. Like, because it's not really swearing.
Right.
So yeah. It's fun to do that.
Nobody swears as good as we Brits, I have to say. We're incredibly good at it.
That is true. I will agree with you on that. That is certainly true. So, and I hope that gives you a taste. And Seward, if you don't recognize him, is from Dracula.
It sounded vaguely familiar. Yeah. It did sound familiar.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So I wanted to pop in there.
The Morlocks got a mention as well, which was fantastic. So everyone's in this. Brilliant.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, there's a lot of Morlocks in this one. This is the only one I did that didn't have a purely Lovecraftian threat. Mm-hmm. You know, the other ones are, you know, full of Shoggoths and tentacles and all kind of, you know, elder things and great old ones and deep ones. And but this is the only non-Lovecraft one, but the most time travel that I've ever put in anything.
Yeah,
I'll never do that again.
How do you find writing time? I've written the odd time travel, and I tend to tie myself in knots. You know, how do you find it? I mean, do you have to sort of bend the laws of physics a fair bit, or do you find your brain sort of works around it pretty well?
I found myself working around it pretty well, and I stuck with kind of the physics of the time machine, you know, itself, and the time traveler in this is very aware and very wary of creating paradoxes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's some neat things that happen in, you know, the second book that turns out to be caused by him because he didn't want to create a paradox. Mm-hmm. So there's stuff like that. The alternate timeline I create gets collapsed at the end. Mm-hmm. Everything more or less kind of gets put back together, kind of, sort of. I tried not to do too much damage to our precious timeline, but it's challenging. You have to kind of. It's not linear at all. This writing this book wasn't linear. Like I wrote the last chapter first.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And then the first chapter second, and then went from there.
Right.
But I kind of wrote the book around that last chapter. I had to change something in it slightly because I didn't want to. That there's a reference to somebody in the last chapter. I had originally intended that person to be someone different than who it became.
Gotcha. Uh-huh.
Because I found out that person I originally wanted to reference had died years before and could not have met these characters.
Right. Unless he was a time traveler as well. Ha ha. There you go.
Right.
There you go.
So, it ends up getting wrapped up in a neat little bow at the end.
Uh-huh.
I hate to say this, James. We're just about out of time for our first segment. I know. You have to promise to come back and see us, though, when the next one comes out and read more for us.
I will definitely do that. I'm working on some different stuff. The next one in this series will go back to Captain Nemo, and it's going to be Captain Nemo and Alan Quatermain in the art book.
Nice. Yeah, you definitely have to come back and read some more for us. Before we go, let us know real quick where we can find you online.
eyeing them all over the place. JamesPalmerBooks.net. You can get a free ebook by signing up for my readers group. It's a pair of sci-fi military sci-fi space opera short stories. I'm on Patreon at James Palmer, patreon.com/JamesPalmer, where I'm going to be serializing a Space Marine versus Kaiju novella here in the next week. So, you know, definitely get in on that. Twitter at Palmer Writer. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I am all over the place. I'm easy to find online.
Thank you. I will get your links put up on our Facebook page. If anybody wants to stalk you, then go there and do that. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show, and can't wait for you to come back.
Well,
yeah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Okay, James.
Yeah, and Map of Time is on Amazon, so yeah, check it out.
Will
awesome.
Do. Fantastic. Thank you. We've got to have you back to talk more time. One of my favorite subjects is time travel, so we got to have you back for that.
Oh, I love time travel. Anytime.
I love the pun. Closing on a pun. Fantastic. Thank you, and have a great rest of your evening.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. And yes, as I said, we will be right back after these here messages, provided I can press the button right.
Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
I was walking down the high street when I heard footsteps behind me, and there was a little old man in scarlet and gray chuckling away. Well, he trotted back to my house, and he sat beside the deli with his tiny hands on his tummy, chuckling away, laughing all day. Oh, to report you to the Gnome Muffin.
Gnome Muffin.
I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me. I'm a laughing gnome. Said the laughing gnome. Well, I gave him roasted toadstools and a glass of dandelion wine. Then I put him on a train to Eastbourne, carried his bag and gave him a fag.
Have you got a nice boy?
Yeah, where do you come from?
No man's land.
Oh, really? In the morning, when I woke up, he was sitting on the edge of my bed with his brother whose name was Fred. He brought him along to sing me a song. All right, let's hear it. Yeah, what's that clicking noise? I'm a laughing gnome and you can't catch me. Haven't you got a gnome to go to?
No, I know that.
Didn't they teach you to get your hair cut at school? You look like a rolling gnome.
Yeah, look at the London School of Eco-Gnomics.
Now they're staying up the chimney, and we're living on caviar and honey, because they're earning me lots of money fighting comedy pros for radio shows. It's the gnome service, of course.
Welcome back to part two.
Well, yeah, a bit of David Bowie, that laughing. I remember seeing one of the very first sort of videos they did for songs back in the day. I thought it was, because I was a kid then, I thought it was great. So
I had no idea what that was.
First single that Bowie released, and it got to like number 97 in the charts back in the day. And he was sort of labeled as a novelty act, and then he brought a few more bits out and then re-released it, and it actually did quite well. So I've never really been a fan of Bowie. I didn't really get me. I love the Laughing Gnome, obviously. I think Space Oddity was good, but that's about it.
That
I've just.
Chipmunk.
Hmm.
It
definitely
like a chipmunk. Alvin Simon Theater.
I hate that. They just irritate me. And anyhow, speaking of things that irritate me, we've not played this for a while, so we're going to play it.
Grab him by the pussy.
You know what uranium is, right? It's a thing called nuclear weapons and other things. Like, lots of things are done with uranium, including some bad things.
Pretty much all you need to know about nuclear physics there from the Trumpmeister General. So thanks. I know he listens in. Thoughts and prayers, Donald. Thoughts and prayers. So it's just I don't know what's going on, to be honest with you. I obviously it's election year as well this year, and funnily enough, I was speaking to my son who turns 18 in September, will be eligible to vote. You know, I've said, get out, make it count, boy. You know, get out there and, make a difference. Mm-hmm. Don't be one of these, you know, too many people sat at home, thought, it's one vote, won't make a difference. And enough people did that.
Yeah.
And look at what we ended up with. So hopefully people, should be like, some great countries. I mean, like, I think Finland, Sweden, Zimbabwe, where voting is compulsory. Obviously, in Zimbabwe, if you don't vote and don't vote for, what was Mugabe, he's dead now. Obviously, Mugabe's party, you get shot in the head. But you know, the sentiment's still there. You know, get out and vote, make your vote count. It obviously works for such great countries as that, but. I know some in Finland, Sweden, you know, it's they make a, you know, it's a holiday, and actually, you know, people, you know, what do you call them, bank holidays in England, whatever. So, you know, there's no excuse. You go, and it's an important day. Here, you know, people don't vote because they can't get off work, and, you know, it's just not convenient or whatever. And it's just wrong. You know, it should be that, you know. Like they did with medical insurance, you know, if you don't vote, you'll get penalized on your taxes or something.
Right. Right.
So I'll take a leaf out of the garbage book and just beat people up. I mean, either way.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's much more effective. I go for that. Violence.
Yeah.
Always go for the violence. Wait.
You know, there's nothing that can't be solved with violence, you know, and I think the more people realize that, the better, really. You know, it's like that alcohol. But, you know, these people always say, oh, you know, you don't have to drink to have a good time. I do, to be honest. You know, without alcohol. I just find the majority of people insufferably boring. You know, but if I have a few beers down me,
then
you know, it sort of takes the edge off. Just take the edge off for me. But maybe it's just me. Just like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm just getting old and grumpy in my old age there, you know. But there you have it. Anyway.
I was going to say, I'll let you know when I'm sober, you know, how I feel about the majority of the people out there.
I was going to say, yeah, I'm not going to hold my breath on that one. But since I haven't had a drink since, Saturday, actually. I had a beer on Saturday, but I mean, I used to drink a hell of a lot in my previous life. You know, I had a sort of career that was based around, you know, bars and that sort of thing. You know, a lot of entertaining clients, etc. But now I just don't go out, and I'm not quite sad enough to sit and get drunk on my own, to be honest. On a Friday night, I'll pack one of the kids off to the fridge to grab me a beer. You know, I'll have a beer, but for a beer and pizza and a movie. But that's I just have, you know, water. It's so very occasionally. But I mean, some days I miss it. What I don't miss is all the days I wrote off with hangovers.
Yeah, those aren't fun.
I lost a lot of Sundays, a hell of a lot of Sundays back in the day, just not being able to open my eyes because my head hurts so badly.
Yeah, I can actually say I've only had a handful of hangovers, and it's been a really, really long time. The last time, you know, I was sick for 2 days, so I decided that that I wouldn't do that anymore.
The worst one I had was, lived back in England, I must have been... God, I can't remember. It was a long time ago. We used to meet my first wife. We used to hang out with these. Yeah, he actually used to be her boss, and we got friendly with him and his wife. We used to hang out a lot. And they just dropped in on impromptu visits because didn't have any beer in. But I tell you what, I have got in because the company I worked for at the time, we'd just done a big promotion, giving away Rioja wine. And this was like 14% proof red Rioja wine, and it was beautiful wine. So I broke that. I had crates of this stuff because obviously it was all for promotion. So we pull in a few crates for ourselves, and we must have drank five bottles between just me and him. Drank about five bottles.
Wow.
Fucking hell! I was so ill. Seriously, a red wine hangover is the worst. I was probably ill for. I mean, the next day was almost. I just wanted to die. And it must have been, it was probably about the Wednesday, that was a Saturday, it's probably about the Wednesday before my stomach was settled enough to even consider eating.
Oh,
I just felt
awful.
So bad. I've never got drunk. I'm lying, I have been drunk on red wine a few times after. So I didn't learn. I did not learn from that lesson. I've been drunk on red wine a few times. And I do like it, but it just hates me.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah.
So, anywho, moving on swiftly. what have we got next, Xtina?
I'm excited for our second segment. We have poet and historical fantasy writer Gerald L. Coleman. So,
now you see, hi Gerald, how you doing?
I did that.
Hi, how are you all?
Hello. I do apologize for Xtina. We were talking about drinking. She's clearly not drunk enough. Gerald is a philosopher, theologian, poet, science fiction, fantasy writer, not historical. We did the historical fantasy. And as fascinating as it was, we've moved on, Xtina, okay? So, Gerald, thank you so much for joining us. How are you this evening?
Listen, I'm very well. And James and Xtina, thank you so much for having me on the program.
Yeah, no, you're thank more you. Than welcome. It is a delight. I don't think we've had many philosophers on the show, to be honest.
Let me say this, James, because you brought up a memory. When I was in college, myself and a group of my friends, we had what was called the Summer of Wine. I think I was a junior on the way to being a senior, and I had a couple of dollars for some reason and had stopped in to buy some wine, and they had these cases of George DeBuff on sale, and I bought maybe four cases of white
nice.
And red and a mixture, and we spent that entire summer drinking all of that wine. And that's
nice.
Probably why it's still a blur at this point as to what actually happened that summer. Mm-hmm. But, yes, I feel you wholeheartedly, my friend.
Fantastic. Yeah, and it's nice while you're doing it, but the aftermath can be devastating.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Was I talking while you're interrupting? I am sorry.
Yes, I did see where I, I have the wrong information on my little cheat sheet here. I totally introduced some wrong.
Who wrote the cheat sheet? Who wrote it? It was you. This is on you. So, Gerald, you're here to talk to us about your book, When Night Falls. I love the tagline, Lord of the Rings meets... Black Panther.
Yes.
You can fill us in. That sounds absolutely fascinating.
Well, I hope it does that. I grew up reading all kinds of science fiction and fantasy, and it really started in elementary school with the wonderful Scholastic Book Fair. That would come around to our elementary school, and
mm-hmm.
you would get your $3 or $4 together and
mm-hmm.
go in and buy your little book. And that's where I found The Raps of Nim, Watership Down. So that was kind of the entree for me. And obviously I was reading comic books at the time. But then all of that evolved into reading full-fledged science fiction and fantasy. And I read everything from Lord of the Rings to Elric of Melny Bonnet to the Conan stuff. I mean, you name it, I was reading it. Glenn Cook's Black Company, C.J. Cherry's The Fated Son, Duncan's The Reluctant Swordsman. I mean, I was reading everything I could get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, it really kind of began to stick with me that as much as I was enjoying reading all that stuff, I couldn't actually see myself in any of it.
All right, yeah.
So when I got to the point where I was ready to really, I knew at some point I wanted to write science fiction and fantasy. And so when I got to the point where I was ready, I knew I was going to be writing something that included characters and centered characters who looked like me, that I had been missing in kind of my reading adventure. And so that was the kind of the genesis of the Three Gifts series. And so When Night Falls is the first book in the series. And I say it's The Lord of the Rings meets Black Panther. It's very classic, epic fantasy, with the high, lofty goals that epic fantasy kind of puts out in front of you. And so it's that, but it's that with a very diverse and inclusive cast of characters and heroes.
You know,
wow.
I have to say, we do have an occasion where we have the authors on that will say that the reason they are writing what they are is because they couldn't find it when they, you know, when they were reading. And I just think that's awesome because,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, with me, I just, I just read and whatever's there, I just read it. And then, again, when I go to write, I've said before, that, you know, I don't have to create anything. It's just all, you know, I don't know. I just think that's really cool. I do. So, I wanted to ask you because it also says poet, you know, when I, you know, was going to introduce you, and even though I did it the wrong way, it does say poet, but, you know, being a fellow poet, what kind of poetry do you write?
Poetry. Okay. So, so poetry for me began in high school, and mm-hmm. it was the kind of stereotypical thing where I had a crush on some girl, and so I wanted to write a little something, write down some lines, and slip it to her in class to try and impress her. And so that was kind of my first foray into poetry. When I got to college as a freshman, that was when I first read the autobiography of Malcolm X. That he wrote along with Alex Haley. And that book was a seismic shift for me in terms mm-hmm. of my awareness of who I was in the world and what my kind of outlook and really thought process even was about being who I was as a black man in the country in which I was born and raised. And so that led to my reading. Obviously I was reading Kant and Derrida and Sartre and all of the other stuff that I had to read for classes, but I was also reading Carter G. Woodson and I was reading Black Athena, and I was reading Shake Answer Joke, and I was reading, you know, everything I could get my hands on that was W.E.B. Du Bois. I mean, The Souls of Black Folk was probably the next most important book for me at that point. And so as I read those things, and those things became a part of my kind of intellectual heritage, then that's when my poetry kind of really began to be reflective of kind of my experiences, given who I was and given the country I was in and given the history kind of I was situated in. So that's what my poetry eventually became. I mean, I'm originally from Lexington, Kentucky, and my people come from a part of Kentucky that is referred to as Appalachia and or Appalachia, depending upon what side of that argument you want to be on. But I connected with some other like-minded poets at the University of Kentucky, and we founded a group called the Appalachian Poets, or Appalachian, again, depending on what part of that argument you want to be on. But I tend to say Appalachian, the Appalachian Poets. And basically, we talk about that. We talk about our heritage. We talk about our family in our poetry. I'm talking about. We talk about the food we grew up with. We talk about the experience of our grandparents. We talk about what it's like to be African American people in this country and in Appalachia in particular. And so those are kind of themes, I guess, around which our writing revolves. I mean, we've got poet laureates like Frank X. Walker, who's a founder. We've got book award winners like Krista Wilkinson and Sheila Lawson, and I mean the list goes. I could name all of them, but we've spent the last kind of 30 years building a kind of repository of poetry from the Black experience, and so that's kind of what the poetry aspect of my writing is really about.
I love how personal that sounds. You know, I am a poet myself, and my poetry, you know, tends to be very, very personal. I mean, you know, reading it, it would be almost like the equivalent of reading my diary. So, that's awesome. Yeah. I would love to read from your poetry. So maybe we need to have you back and do like poetry night. That'd be a lot of fun.
But, I'd be glad to do
it. Yeah. So you are here to talk to us about your book, When Night Falls. Can you tell us a little about it?
Yes. Again, it's epic fantasy, a very classic kind of take on the genre, but it's based around a diverse cast of characters. The central protagonist is a character called Bantu, and he exists in a country that is not his own, and he is the commander general of a group of mercenaries called the People's Company. And the story kind of picks up after the prelude, which has the inciting incident in it. The story picks up from chapter one in kind of classic epic fantasy fashion. It sets you down into the world. And then the rest of it, from When Night Falls, the second book, Plague of Shadows, the next book I'm working on, is really about those kind of classic epic fantasy kind of arcs about these people taking on the big bad, who is trying to, or big bads, plural, who are trying to take over the world, and it's their job to try and kind of thwart those plans. But underneath that is, at least for me, is always the human stories, the relationships between the characters, and what they go through is just as important as kind of the broad overarching themes.
Definitely. Well, I want to hear more about it. Do you have an excerpt for us?
Sure. I'm going to read just a few pages from the prelude. And again, this is the inciting incident, which is where we pick up and give you a little taste of it.
It's all yours.
Telemarineth sat on the hilltop, looking down on where the spires of El Sithel Menereth had stood, ancient and resplendent, against the skyline as recently as dawn. Now all she could see was thick black smoke, signaling the presence of raging fires below. From time to time, the earth shook underneath her, forcing her to brace herself with her hands to keep from being tossed about. Normally, she would have spoken to the clouds to keep the rain at bay until she was gone, but she could not afford to attract that kind of attention. Some of the betrayers were probably still in the city below. Her skin tingled, but she did not turn her head. Tella knew before he arrived exactly who it would be. Osmothamel had always liked shifting. He claimed it was easier on the place you left as well as where you arrived. If you questioned it, he would launch into a lecture about the metaphysics and the nature of movement. The young were always particular about certain things, but Tella was in no mood for lectures. His voice rumbled behind her. Tella, I have come. She continued gazing down on burning El Sithel Menereth. She knew she sounded tired, but she didn't care to try to modulate her voice. Tella spoke without turning to look at him, transfixed by the fires raging and ravaging the city below. Her question was punctuated by the periodic flash of lightning high in the sky above. How is Eos? She's safe. She's troubled, but she's safe. And that's all that matters. Tella Marinus could feel him scanning the hillside. She knew what he would say next, but cut him off as he opened his mouth. I do not know what is keeping Tut Hameldazar. They both nearly jumped when a third voice spoke from above. The Thaumaturgus has arrived. The awaited one is here. I have come. The voice was rich, melodic, and completely full of itself. Tut Hameldazar not simply wielded the gift for more than an eon. He had taught its nuances in the Idris, even debated its complexity on the pavilion. He always spoke as if he had an audience, whether he had one or not. He was one of the eldest of them all. Telemarineth looked up to watch him float down out of the sky, landing gently with a flourish not far from where Oz stood. Laughing softly, she watched as Tutmeldazar bowed deeply with another flourish, while Osmothamel looked at him as if he were considering what part of him to break. Tut's robe was smartly cut, was fitted to his slim frame. The purple, gold, and gray robe was tattered a bit around the edges, but somehow his boots shone glossy black while his cloak flapped lightly in the wind. Had he stopped to polish his boots, she thought. Though his bronze-colored face was lightly smudged, his silvery white hair sparkled as it hung loosely around his shoulders. Though her heart was pained, she could not keep a hint of mirth out of her voice. "Tut, you can never stop putting on the performance, can you?" He shook his head at her, making a tisking sound with his tongue as he said, "Tell her sometimes the performance is all you have, no?" Tut looked skyward with irritation, then absently waved his hand. The rain continued to fall, but it did not touch the hilltop. With a brief nod accompanied by a grim grin, he clasped his hands behind his back and stepped closer to her. Tella took a deep breath. She stood brushing at the pale blue gossamer gown she wore as she rose. The sleeves were fitted from shoulder to elbow but flared into bell cuffs. The high collar curved up slowly to her ears. Her slippers were delicate with sparkling gems covering the sharply curved toes. The gems picked up what little light remained. She towered over mortals, though Oz and Tut were a half head taller still, while the rest of their brothers and sisters were fighting for their lives along with what was left of the world. She had been able to contact these two, convincing them to leave the fighting. They waited for her to speak. After all, she had contacted them. They had come to her call. For that, she was grateful. It could not have been easy for Azamatha Mel to leave his beloved Oz. Tutmeldazar would have gotten himself killed strolling up to the Hall of Adoration. No doubt he would have called the betrayers out to meet him in formal combat right there on the great steps. He would have died. He was the thaumaturgist, so many of the betrayers would have fallen beneath his wrath. The countryside would have been decimated for 1,000 miles in every direction, but in the end, they would have taken him with them. Had she not gotten to him first, it would have been a waste, a costly, disastrous waste. I think that's 5 minutes.
I was just, you know what, my co-host said, you know, I'm going to let you decide, you know, how long we let him read for, and I was just going to let you keep going because that was too good.
Yeah, I was loving that. I thought, just keep going. Brilliant, loving it.
I know they always cut off way too soon, as far as I, you know, my liking. But that was great. And, you know,
I
think we should get him back next week to read whatever excerpts we have. Just, you know, we're just going to let him do it now.
Yeah. Listen, and I'd be glad to come back anytime you guys want me. I've had a blast.
Yeah. So, you know, I was going to say, you know, because I have to say it right, you know, that was science fiction fantasy author and poet Gerald L. Coleman. I had to, you know, do it well because, you know, I don't even know how that happened earlier. So, you know, my apologies there.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
No, I have to ask about the philosopher. I mean, how does that manifest itself with you?
You mean in the work?
Yeah. How do you be a philosopher? I know it's a bit of an ignorant question because I have no idea. Obviously, I'm familiar with the ancient philosophers, etc. Your René Descartes and Plato, etc. But how do you bring it out in your work, or do you just do pure philosophy work, or how does that happen?
Right. Yeah. You know, I wish I had, not necessarily lived in that period. But I wish that we still had what we used to call public intellectuals, because there were people who at one time or other, you know, practiced philosophy and theology in the market, the public market square. And and really we have talking heads now, but they aren't anything like the public intellectuals we used to have in the country and even around the world. And so for me, my philosophy plays itself out in my writing, both in the poetry and in the science fiction and fantasy, and as an amateur philosopher in terms of, I mean, I'm educated as a philosopher and a theologian, but unless you're teaching philosophy at a university, it's very difficult to find ways in which to kind of practice that in the marketplace. And so for me, it plays itself out in my writing. I try and do it in such a way that you don't really see it as you're reading, but it's there in the background as an underpinning to how characters view the world, to the theology that the characters practice or believe in, to the kinds of principles that these various characters apply in their lives, and why, what motivates them to do what. So that's how it kind of plays itself out in my work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you say you were educated in philosophy. I mean, the reason I ask, when I at university, my one of my flatmates was actually, one of his majors was the history of philosophy, and we had some, again, back to the beer. He was great to get drunk with. You know, because we have some very, you know, it's like the perfect storm. You've got students, beer, philosophy, and we would sit up all night and have some really weird conversations. But
fascinating
stuff. You know,
right? Yes, exactly. I mean, the thing, I actually, when I first went to university, I went to become an architect. That was going to be my major. And while I was doing the prerequisites, because the first 2 years of the architectural program were basically you just doing the prerequisites before you got into the actual work in the third year. And so I was doing kind of prerequisite stuff and decided to take a philosophy 100 course as one of my kind of to fill one of those prerequisite slots. And so I'm sitting in this 100 level philosophy class. And the guy walks in, he writes his name on the board, Dr. Holbrook, and then he turns around and he says, "What are you sitting on?" And someone threw their hand up and said, "A chair." And he said, "How do you know it's a chair?" And he spent the next 50 minutes deconstructing everything we thought we knew, understood, and believed. And when he left, I sat in that classroom for another 15 minutes, just stunned. Because we don't ever really often think about the presuppositions that we kind of hold on to that we think are truths, but are actually not truths. They're just presuppositions that no one has challenged yet, right? And so I sat there stunned. I mean, just he had just deconstructed my entire worldview in the matter of 50 minutes. And I immediately left that room and went and changed my major from architecture to philosophy.
Wow.
That's how that came about.
I wish
someone had pulled me aside and told me that you can't make a living as a philosopher, but that would have been a different story.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Same, you know,
yeah, I love that story.
But it's the same thing when, you know, somebody asks, "So how's the poetry going?" Well, you know, I write a lot of it, but not really a big seller, but
right. Yeah. But, not just kind of genre writer, but every poet I know is generally a professor or a teacher or something else. You know, they have to pay the bills, right? I mean, you can make a little bit of money, and sometimes if your name gets big enough, you can make a living, but most of us have to have something else going on at the same time.
If I was doing it for money, I probably wouldn't be doing it. So
you just starve to death.
But wouldn't it be great if we lived in a world that you could, like, you know, really just generally make a living doing that without having to be this lottery winning, you know, author who gets that kind of spark that everybody blows up, and everybody now knows your name, right?
I have read some of the contemporary poets that are, you know, the ones that are on the shelves, and I'm paging through this, and I'm going, this is what's selling? This is, you know, in my opinion, this is awful. I mean, you know.
Don't get me started on the publishing industry and how they select what goes out and how they hype it up. Don't get me started.
I know. That's for all. We'll have to have you back on. That's a whole other show.
I like Extina's idea. We should have a whole show dedicated to poetry. I think that would be. No, seriously, I think we should do that.
I would have a lot.
Hey, I'm in. Let me know, and I'm in. Anytime.
Gerald will be in, so I'm sure we could round up a few poets. We know a few.
We
know a few. you know.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, cool. So, we should do that.
I think we're getting close to the end of the show, Gerald. So tell us where we can find you online.
Yeah, anyone looking for me can find me at GeraldLColeman.com.
Awesome. That's it.
Yeah,
great.
Brilliant.
Well, yeah, it's simple. I like that. I will get that up on our – well, yeah, a lot of people go through, you know, all the different places and stuff. And, no, that's great. You can – all the information's right there. I like it.
Right,
I will get that
right
on our Facebook page. If anybody wants to stalk you, then go there and do it. And, yeah, I would love to trade some poetry with you. I think that's – you know, I can't wait to have you back. So, and he's already said he is coming back, so I don't have to beg him to come back. So.
Yeah, you go. You can come back to our special poetry show. That'd be brilliant. That'd be great. So, Gerald, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, James, extended the pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
You
have
sir.
A wonderful rest of your evening, and we will speak to you again very soon.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye-bye. Well,
ooh,
I cannot believe it's flown. It has flown by. It's just 1 minute. It's like, oh, you know, beginning of the show and everything. It's like, it's night time. So, you know, I guess it's because we have such a great time. A pair of wonderful guests there, even though you did introduce Gerald wrong, obviously. But, you know, I'm, you know, to be fair, that's on a par with me pressing the wrong button every now and then. It's part of the show's charm, isn't it? It's part of the rustic charm, I like to think. But it is, unfortunately, it is that we were at that time where we have to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight.
Your tiger feet, your tiger feet.